I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I'm curious, what have you taken out of the interviews that we've never heard before?
Oh boy, are you about to find out. Hi, I'm Cody Goff with The Very Curious, Curiosity.com.
And I'm Ashley Hamer. Today, we're going to learn lots of different things from our favorite guests, both old and new.
Every week, we explore what we don't know because curiosity makes you smarter.
This is the Curiosity Podcast.
This is a very special episode with some very special news at the end, so you're going to want to stick around.
You'll hear some of our recent guests talk about stuff we weren't able to include in their episodes and learn a little about a variety of things. Kind of like our daily podcast, honestly.
Plus, we'll hear from a guest you've never heard from before, ever. And as always, Ashley will drop in from time to time to inject some knowledge. And again, we'll wrap up with an extremely important announcement, if I didn't already mention that, so don't touch that dial.
We'll talk about yoga, volcanoes, meditation, and the occult? Yeah, this is going to be a fun one.
We'll start with a very popular recent guest, Alex Hutchinson. He's the author of Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Love that title. Alex competed as a middle and long distance runner for the Canadian national team and spent years conducting research on the limits of the human body. And we had a great conversation about how our limits are actually a lot more mental than physical. The episode is definitely worth checking out, and we talked a lot about how to improve your running times or lift heavier stuff with the right amount of training. But I know that activities like yoga and Pilates are also really popular these days. I'm into DDP yoga myself. Those activities are a lot harder to quantify, though. You know, if you're lifting, you can see your progress in numbers, and if you're running, obviously you're going after faster times on a clock. But with yoga, it's not like you're measuring how many inches you can stretch or anything. So here's what Alex had to say when I asked him this question. Is there a good way to develop endurance or measure your progress with yoga or other less quantifiable activities?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think the first thing you have to ask in that context is, what is your goal? Is your goal to be on a never-ending staircase of improvement? Because, you know, that for runners, that's actually a bit of a trap to always think that tomorrow's run should be a little faster than today's and the next day's should be a little bit faster. And sometimes someone may have a yoga practice that makes them happy and keeps them healthy, and they don't necessarily need to be stretching a little farther or pushing themselves a little deeper to get the benefits of it. So I think that's maybe one thing to keep in mind. But beyond that, because most of us are, you know, generally trying to get a little bit better at things we do, I think it's really domain specific. You have to, in a sense, it's kind of like if you're trying to find interesting answers, you have to ask the right question. And it's the same thing. If you're trying to track your progress, you have to understand what it is that you want to progress and not fall for the mistake of whatever is easiest to quantify. That's what we're going to try and improve. Because it may be that maybe in yoga, how far you're able to push a given stretch is easy to kind of measure, but that maybe not be the point of that particular exercise. The point may be to be cultivating, you know, awareness of your breath or whatever the case may be. And so I realize I'm sort of punting on the question here, but I think you really, for any of these, especially non-quantifiable activities, you have to think really carefully about what it is you're trying to optimize and not fall for the trap of optimizing something just because you can measure progress in it.
I thought that was a great answer. I know it's kind of a bit of a left field question, but it just popped into my head because I know there are people participating in very different activities than the traditional running or lifting and want to make sure that we're able to speak to that. Because again, not just the numbers thing with running and lifting, but when you're running a race, for example, and you hit that last stretch, you know you're near the end, and then you can do that final sprint, that final burst of energy, and kind of get it done, whereas certain other activities are maybe a little bit more, they're not quite as demanding on that last boost, which you talk about quite a bit in that final stretch that runners especially are used to.
Yeah, and I think in a running race, yeah, as you say, you see people sprinting towards the finish because they're trying to squeeze out the last drops out of the rag, as it were. And that's an interesting phenomenon in its own right. But it definitely doesn't generalize to all activities. And again, to use yoga as an example, I think some of the ideas we've been talking about awareness, mindful awareness of discomfort and enduring are absolutely crucial and fundamental to the practice of at least some types of yoga. But that doesn't mean you're trying to push yourself to your maximum in yoga or to, you know, there's no finishing sprint in yoga. But the ability to cultivate the awareness of your body and to dissociate the emotional response, to be able to just be aware of feedback from your body without judging it, I think that's integral to yoga. And it's also has a lot in common with the ability to, say, maintain your pace in a marathon. It's all about bodily awareness and not letting signals from your body trick you into thinking you've reached a limit, to allowing yourself to either stay in a pose for longer or to maintain your pace for longer, and understand that discomfort doesn't signal, it's a warning sign, not a stop sign.
Great advice and awesome observation, obviously based on lots of really great research in the book. Is that kind of the main takeaway, is that practice makes perfect and that's how you're going to have better endurance?
I think that's certainly a very valuable practical takeaway, that the best way to get better is to get out and do something. The deeper takeaway for me is that I hope people would take away from the book is that limits that really feel physical, that feel like a brick wall in a sense, are mostly mediated by the brain. And that means they're negotiable. And I think just having that awareness, understanding that the feeling that you can't go any farther doesn't really mean that your body is tapped out. I think that has tremendous potential for helping people to motivate themselves to keep pushing if that's what they choose to do.
I know what you're thinking. Who the heck worries about endurance and competition when they're doing yoga? Competitive yoga athletes, obviously. While it might seem completely counter to its basic principles, yoga is quickly growing as a competitive sport. There's even a push to make it an Olympic event. In the United States, the sport's national governing body is USA Yoga, which makes the rules for how competitions are scored. In their events, competitors must perform 6 poses within 3 minutes, and each pose is scored on a scale from 1 to 10, with a maximum possible total score of 60. But these events are hard. According to an article by Shavi Lieber for Racked, the average score is only 30, and the highest score ever recorded was just 42. You have to have perfect alignment, balance, and breath control all at once. It's no easy feat. As you might expect, a lot of yoga practitioners have problems with their practice becoming competitive. But adherents say it's less about competition and more about seeing what you can do as an individual. As one competitor told Lieber, quote, "Winning doesn't motivate us. We are there to help our personal growth," end quote.
The next guest you're going to hear from is somebody you've never heard before on the Curiosity Podcast. But first, we want to thank one of our sponsors, LinkedIn. We know you've heard of LinkedIn, of course, but did you know that it's an incredible place to find quality talent? If you're looking to hire, then LinkedIn is the way to go. Don't settle for posting a job and just hoping the right person will find you and apply.
70% of the U.S. workforce is already on LinkedIn. And when it comes to delivering quality candidates, businesses rate LinkedIn jobs 40% higher than job boards. I mean, think about your company's job boards. How often do you check them, let alone anybody else? Then there's LinkedIn. 22 million professionals view and apply to jobs on LinkedIn every week, in every industry, even yours and mine.
And when you're looking to fill a position, LinkedIn takes potential candidates and looks at their skills, experiences, location, and more to match and promote your job to the right professionals.
Before you look for your next hire, visit linkedin.com/curiosity and get a $50 credit toward your first job post.
I literally work at Curiosity because of LinkedIn. Seriously. So if you're not using LinkedIn for your hiring needs, you're missing out on quality talent like me. So get a $50 credit towards your first job post at linkedin.com/curiosity.
One more time, that's linkedin.com/curiosity. Head their way and get your $50 credit today. Terms and conditions apply.
Up next is a guest you have never heard from. I want to give a little background first. Last October, our editor-in-chief at the time was really into the idea of doing a spooky Halloween-type special episode. And I happened to know a guy who is an occult hobbyist? I don't really know how to say it. He's really plugged into the world of modern magic. And it's magic with a CK. Magic with a CK was defined in the early 1900s by Aleister Crowley as the science and art of causing change to occur in conformity with will. And it's used to differentiate the occult magic, like invocation or divination, from performance magic, like pulling a rabbit out of a hat.
Anyway, let's just say that the occult is still around in 2018, and there are lots of people out there who practice magic with a CK. And like I said, I know a guy who's pretty well versed in the history and modern practice of the occult and the magic they practice. Perfect for Halloween, right? So I did this interview. And you know who it was with? My oldest brother, Jason. We had a really interesting conversation, but we decided the interview didn't really make sense for a full episode for this show for our audience. But I recently listened back to the interview, and I was like, you know what? There's some good stuff in there that I think our audience would find interesting. So here's a little excerpt from an unreleased episode with my brother Jason that I thought was pretty interesting, especially if you've ever wondered about tarot cards or Ouija boards.
Where do tarot and Ouija fall into all of this?
The tarot is part of the Kabbalistic system, the Kabbalah. The tarot is the lines in between the spheres on the Tree of Life. So the tarot has a deep symbolism in Egyptian mythology and Greek symbolism and kind of astrological stuff, planetary correspondences, as well as herbs. I mean, there's a lot that goes into the tarot. Ouija, I think, was just a board game. That they literally made for at fun at home.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Not really so, deep there.
Yeah, Ouija is, I believe, just like the gaming company made it. The Ouija board itself does not have any occult history.
I'm actually looking online. Yeah, it was a parlor game unrelated to the occult.
Yeah.
It was popularized as a divining tool during World War I by spiritualist Pearl Curran.
Okay. Yeah.
But before that, wow, it really was just...
Yeah, it's a board game, literally.
Wow, that's a lot less dark than I thought.
No, yeah, Ouija, totally not dark. Tarot, interesting. You know, the tarot, like the devil and death cards are not the worst. Interesting.
What do you mean not the worst?
Everybody thinks, well, the devil card or the death card would be the worst. It's actually not.
What is?
It all depends on how they are laid with the other cards, but typically the tower is a pretty bad card.
What's the tower?
It's one of the major arcana of the tarot.
But I mean, what does it represent?
Downfall, kind of. Like Sauron.
Oh, okay, yeah. Like
think that.
Lord of the Rings, okay. Not so good.
That's where that came from.
All right, cool. Good to know.
A tarot deck is made up of the minor arcana and the major arcana. The minor arcana is a lot like a regular deck of playing cards, in that it has four suits. But instead of spades, hearts, diamonds, and clubs, it has wands, swords, cups, and circles or pentacles. The major arcana, by contrast, are those one-off picture cards most people probably associate with tarot. It's where you'll see cards like the devil, death, and the tower. Like Jason says, the devil and death cards aren't all that bad. Death just signifies the end of a major phase of your life. And the devil is just a warning that there's some sort of negativity going on. The tower card, however, is super bad. It usually depicts a lightning bolt striking a tower on a stormy night and suggests that something terrible is going to strike you without warning. The Ten of Swords is also not one you want to see. It says that you'll suffer some unwelcome surprise in the near future. Same for the Five of Pentacles, which points to a time of financial strife or adversity. So why are we digging so far into tarot on a podcast that usually deals with science? Well, tarot isn't the magical snake oil you might think. Most people associate tarot card readings with psychic readings, but they're actually pretty different. Instead of a psychic telling you your future, tarot is designed to make you think about your own life. Like, have you ever flipped a coin to decide where to go to dinner, and the minute the coin lands on heads, you wish it had landed on tails? The coin helped you realize the decision you really wanted to make. Tarot cards are the same way. By asking broad questions and being open to what the cards might be saying, you can help understand what you really want and need in your life. It's stuff you know already. The cards can just help you find it.
Just a few weeks ago, we talked to Dr. Lucy Jones, a leading seismologist and author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. It's funny because we were going to talk about natural disasters and kind of ended up zooming out and talking about human psychology and how we prepare for and react to natural disasters. The conversation was really interesting, but I almost kind of felt bad because we barely talked about the book. But we did have a short conversation about one disaster that I'm happy to share now. In her book, Dr. Lucy Jones writes about the Laki eruption in Iceland in 1783 to 1784, which, quote, researchers believe is the deadliest natural disaster in human history. The total death toll was in the millions, and the devastation spanned the globe, unquote. A volcano eruption in Iceland, though? The deadliest? I had to find out.
How? By the way, how did it kill millions of people?
Okay. In Iceland itself, it killed about a quarter of the population, mostly from starvation. It put out poisonous gases that poisoned all of the land-based food. So basically, the only thing left to eat had to come from the ocean. And people were poisoned by this contaminated food. But then the gases continued to spread out over Europe, and the poisonous gases directly killed people in Europe. They compared the death rate that summer to the long-term death rate around the time in the UK and found an extra 23,000 deaths. So, and then probably at least that many across Europe because people were clearly dying. You know, they didn't know that it was coming from the volcano in Iceland. It was that people went outside and would collapse while trying to work in the fields. But that's still, we're still on the 100,000 dead sort of category. To go beyond that, what happens is that gases were ejected. Some of them were in lower level eruptions that then settled in Iceland or blew over to the continent. Some of them were ejected high up into the atmosphere and got into the stratosphere. And when you start putting sulfates up into the atmosphere, it blocks incoming light and it cooled the Earth. We saw this with the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in 1993. It cooled the Earth by about a degree and a half Fahrenheit, a little under a degree centigrade. And the Icelandic volcanoes have an easier time getting gases into the stratosphere because the stratosphere is thinner up in the polar regions than at the equator. So there was enough gas that got the sulfates up into the stratosphere, and then they stay for a few years because it's so dry there, there's nothing washing them out. And they travel around the world, and they cool the continents, which disrupts the monsoons, because the monsoons happen when you have a warm ocean, or the continent heats up during the summer, and the cooler ocean then sets up the flow. When that didn't happen, the Nile didn't flood. Egypt went through a major famine that killed a sixth of its population, probably 500,000 people or more. There were also major famines in India and Japan. And, you know, they think that there was also an El Nino that year. So it isn't purely the fault of the volcano. But the famine in India killed 11 million people, and the famine in Japan killed over 1 million people. So you sum all that up and subtract a few for saying that that's not all the volcanoes doing, you still are talking about more than 1 million people, maybe well more than 1 million people dying because of that one eruption.
That is incredible, and yet not as memorable as something like maybe Pompeii, where we have a, you know, it's a tourist spot, right?
Right. It's a better story in Pompeii. But, you know, actually, in Iceland, this is the defining event of their culture. It became a whole nation of refugees. Basically, all of the main cropland area was covered by lava. And so people had to leave their homes. Most of the church records of births and deaths fall apart at that point because there was nobody left to make the records. So in Iceland, it is sort of one of their defining characteristics of the whole country. But they're seeing it from their own perspective of losing a quarter of their population. They had no idea that the rest of this was going on.
Are you ready for literally the most seamless transition ever?
Am I?
One of our sponsors today exists specifically in the event that something happens like an earthquake or a flood or a volcano, or even a less natural disaster like a house fire or theft.
Cody's talking about Backblaze, a data storage provider that offers unlimited cloud backups for your Mac or PC for just $5 a month.
What if something happened today and your computer got a virus or got hacked or stolen? What would you do? If your files are not backed up, then what?
It's true. In today's crazy computer world, it is so important to back up your files. And it's never been easier because we have a special offer for Curiosity podcast listeners. Visit backblaze.com/curiosity to try Backblaze for free for 15 days.
See for yourself how easy it is. Then start protecting your files for just $5 a month. Backblaze backs up everything, your photos, documents, videos, projects, even your external hard drives. Remember, backup is unlimited.
You can leave out files you don't want backed up, and you can access your data anywhere in the world, on the web or on your phone. If you want, they can even ship you a hard drive overnight to restore your files.
They use encryption to protect your data, and two-factor authentication is available to keep your account even more secure. Now is the time to back up your files. Do it today, free for 15 days, at backblaze.com/curiosity.
Again, get your 15-day free trial and then protect all of your data for just $5 a month at backblaze.com/curiosity.
Back to another more recent episode. We talked to Dr. Rick Hansen about why resilience is the key to well-being in a changing world. He wrote the book Resilient: How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. The whole episode is really worth listening to, but to kind of sum it up, he talks about how the world around us is always going to change. So if we want to find a way to be happy, then one of the best ways to do it is by growing internal resources. So you're about to hear a quick 60-second explanation of why that's important. And then he talks a little bit about meditation. What's interesting is that whether you meditate every day or you've never meditated in your life, he still has a great takeaway from the world of meditation that you can use to become more resilient and, of course, find happiness as a result.
To have well-being, which is my primary focus here, and be able to contribute to the world, you know, based on a person's values, it's really good to have external conditions around you that are as good as they can be. Obviously, you know, look for a good partner, look for a good job, try to live in a good place, you know, try to install stop signs near schools. Okay, good. That said, we tend to move as people from situation to situation, and also external conditions often kind of end, they fall apart. And what we have inside ourselves in terms of durable trait-based inner resources is what we take with us wherever we go. So I think it's really useful to, you know, have good relations with friends and family and intimate partners and so forth. What's even more useful is to really internalize what it feels like to have a good friend or a good intimate partner or to be close with your family, so that you have that inside you, even if something changes in that relationship outside you.
I think internalizing is part of the trick behind all of this. And you're a big proponent of meditation. Is this where that comes in?
I think meditation is a really useful practice, but it, like many other things, is a useful way to generate states of being. And just to kind of pop back up and out, Cody, if I could, isn't it interesting that we're having experiences continually, but most of us don't pay much attention to the actual process of experiencing? And we don't pay much attention to the internal factors that nudge our experiences for better or worse, even though we live in our experiences, in a sense, in a profound sense, we are our experiences, right? That's all we know, from which we infer that there's a material world outside of our phenomenology that somehow in our bodies is making our experiences. And this is kind of deep stuff that's under our nose. And yet, to your podcast type here, how often are people curious about the actual process of experiencing? And how often are people actually curious about how to make the most of it in terms of lasting value? I don't think most people are very curious about that. And one of my hopes is that people in general, for multiple reasons, will actually become more curious about their process of experiencing and curious about the process of growing, of healing, learning, developing, becoming more skillful, becoming more competent, cultivating various virtues, and even on the pathway to self-actualization and awakening, becoming curious about the process of growing. People are often not very curious about that. So anyway, back to meditation. Meditation is a great opportunity to be curious about experiencing the stream of consciousness, the mind unfolding, which is right available to us without getting mystical about it. There is hearing, there is seeing, there is thinking, there is remembering, there is imagining, there is wanting, there is hurting. It's all happening. Meditation is a great opportunity because then you're not distracted by shiny objects. You're just watching the stream of consciousness roll by, breath after breath after breath. That is really instructive, as well as typically calming and promoting of resilience along the way. That said, as you're having experiences while meditating or while jogging or walking the dog or holding hands with your sweetie or sitting down to pray or offering a little bit of gratitude as you eat or hanging out with your friends, all right? One experience after another is occurring, including maybe what seems like more special experiences, say in meditation. The question always remains, what are the lasting residues left behind by those experiences? And I live in the, you know, I've been meditating since 1974. I teach meditation. You know, I think it's useful for people. And there are many different kinds of meditation. And I'm not pushing any particular kind of meditation or meditation in general. That said, I've known a lot of meditators who are as neurotic as ever. They're really at peace when they're on the cushion, because the cushion or the meditation practice they're doing is an external source of their state of being at that time. They're good or bad. But when they get up off the cushion, they're not taking anything with themselves. So the next time they're stuck in traffic or dealing with an email or in an argument with their partner, they are as irritable or prickly or grouchy as ever, right? And so one of the key points here is that experiencing does not equal growing, does not equal learning. In particular, we're very quick to learn, to turn experiences of fact or concept into knowledge. We do that pretty rapidly. But at the end of the day, I think what most people really care about is their mood or what it feels like inside their body or their outlook or their attitude in general or how skillful they are with other people or, you know, in managing their own mind. That's another domain of skillfulness or competence. And so I think that kind of learning, social, emotional, motivational, somatic, attitudinal, even spiritual learning, is the learning that most people really care about. And for that kind of learning to occur, we must slow the brain down so it can actually physically be changed by those kinds of experiences.
It sounds to me like presence of mind is a really key component to all of this.
Yeah, because if you're not present, you can't be aware of the opportunity for internalization. You're right. And then you need that presence of mind as well to internalize. Now, that said, the brain is so fast. Neurons are firing 5 to 50 times a second. Large-scale patterns of synchronized neural activity that are tracked through measuring brainwaves, they're happening 5, 10, 80, 100 times a second. The brain is really quick. So over the course of a breath or two or three, that's roughly long enough to begin the process of consolidation. The more, the better. There is a kind of quote-unquote dosing effect. But the process of internalization, it's really useful to appreciate, is something that people can do on the fly. It's private. It's internal. Nobody needs to know that you're doing it. And yet, as people do it, let's say a few times a day, maybe a half a dozen times a day, it takes less than 5 minutes total, probably, over the course of a day. As people do that, they really do start to feel like they're filling themselves up from the inside out. Instead of, as many people feel these days, kind of like they're running on empty, or instead of feeling that they have deep down kind of a hungry heart through this process of internalization that we're talking about, people, it's the essence of self-reliance. People become stronger. They become more resilient. They also become happier. And interestingly, as people resource themselves, research shows, and they fill up their own cup, they tend to be more generous, forgiving, loving, and reasonable to deal with other people.
If you're interested in meditation but aren't sure what style you should try, have I got a resource for you. Curiosity made an entire video about how different styles of meditation affect your brain in different ways. It's called What's the Best Way to Meditate? And you can find it in the latest episode section of our Facebook page, on our YouTube channel, or in the show notes.
We end every episode with the Curiosity Challenge, where I ask my guest about something I learned about on Curiosity.com. But I don't have a guest today, right? I did think it would be fun for Ashley and me to swap questions, but the thing is, she's our managing editor, and she's either written, edited, or read pretty much every article on Curiosity.com. So that would not be fair at all, right? So fortunately, you've never heard the Curiosity Challenge I did with my brother Jason last October. So here's that. I'm going to give you a little trivia question, maybe teach you something possibly that you don't know. There was a very famous inventor who actually patented a spirit phone. The inventor had plans to create a device.
Tesla?
That would, hold on, that would communicate with the dead. But this was like actually going to be a real thing. He wanted the device not to function by any occult means, but by scientific methods. So your guess is Tesla.
I would just guess Tesla.
Just right off the bat. Kind of close. It was Thomas Edison.
Oh.
It was Thomas. Geez. In 1920, Edison told American Magazine that he had been working on his spirit phone for some time. News that shocked the public. He was, quote, building an apparatus to see if it is possible for personalities which have left this earth to communicate with us. unquote. And, well, he never quite finished it up. There are virtually no records, plans, or prototypes of this spirit phone, but we do have evidence that he toyed with
virtually
the idea.
No prototypes? Because that seems suspicious. It's like, yeah, he got one. We don't know where it is.
I wish I knew, but you can learn more about that on curiosity.com. We've got an article on Thomas Edison inventing the spirit phone.
I like it.
So there you go. And I believe you've got a trivia question for me as well, which has nothing to do with what we've been talking about today.
Oh, geez. Okay, trivia question. Yes. Who was the Grateful Dead's keyboard player when Jerry Garcia died?
Wow. I'm not going to know this at all. No idea. I can't
name it. Vince Wilnick.
It was Vince. Nice. Vince.
Wilnick, yeah.
Vince Wilnick. How long was he with the Grateful Dead?
After Brent Midland died, I believe, 89. I think he died, so I think the last run of it, the last few years, Bruce Hornsby was in there on piano as well for a while, so there was a two keyboard player time, but yeah, most of the shows I saw with Jerry, it was Vince, yeah.
How many Grateful Dead shows have you been to?
Well, I mean, when Jerry was alive, actual Grateful Dead, not counting Further and Dead & Company current incarnations, I think I went to like 10 shows.
How about Fish? Know.
I lost track.
Wait a minute, Cody. So just because I've written, read, edited, done pretty much everything with a lot of the stuff on curiosity.com, that doesn't mean I remember all of it. That's a lot. I think you can ask me questions and we can see if I remember the answers.
All right, you really want to do the curiosity challenge?
I do.
All right. Well, fortunately, I prepared for an occasion such as this. We're going to lightning round this.
Okay.
This is kind of like the daily podcast that we do.
Yeah.
Where we learn lots of new little random things in just a few minutes.
You're going to ask me a question. I'm going to give you my answer. And then you're just going to tell me whether it's right or wrong and tell me the right answer if I'm wrong.
Yeah. Let's do a handful. We'll let our hair down a little bit.
I'm ready.
All right. Woo. Here's your first question. Starkenberger's Castle is a place in Austria where you can go swimming. They have 7 pools that are about 13 feet deep, but they're not filled with water. What is the substance that you can swim in?
Beer.
Yes. The beer pools began in 2005 when the fermentation cellar became obsolete. Relaxing in the hot tubs of beer may actually be good for you. It's believed that the nutrients in the beer help condition skin.
Yeah.
And may help cure wounds and psoriasis.
Wow. All right. Don't drink it. That's gross.
That's very gross. It'll cost you a few $100, though, so it's not cheap.
Yeah.
All right, here's another one. 1/5 of all mammal species are what type of animal?
Oh, no.
Yeah, about 20% of all mammal species are what type of animal?
This is wrong. Rodent?
No, you're kind of close.
Okay.
Bats.
Oh, that's right. Man, that's amazing.
Scientists believe that their proliferation has to do with their extraordinary ability to adapt quickly to new environments. They tend to evolve very specialized bodies and behaviors depending on the region where they live. And you can look at different species and see a huge diversity in their physicalities and their diets.
All those bats out there, and you probably hardly ever see them.
Yeah. Let's try this. Question number 3. A man named Victor Lustig may have been the smoothest con man the world has ever seen. On the Curiosity Daily a few weeks ago, we talked about a guy that sold the Brooklyn Bridge several times. So Victor Lustig is most famous for his unbelievable scheme in 1925. It's not the Brooklyn Bridge. He made a deal to sell a very famous structure, and he almost did it successfully a second time the same year. What did he sell?
Boy, that was close. That was the Eiffel Tower.
It was the Eiffel Tower. Lustig met with scrap metal dealers in Paris to sell one of them the metal of the Eiffel Tower after the tower was to be torn down. And the winning bidder paid him the equivalent of $1 million of today's dollars. And Lustig fled once he had the money in hand. And the guy who got conned discovered it was a scam, but he didn't report it because he was too ashamed that he fell for such a stupid scheme. And then Lustig repeated the scheme 6 months later, but fled to the U.S. when it wasn't going according to plan. All right, here's another one. Alcohol affects your perception, right? Well, a 2015 study from Bristol University showed how many drinks is the ideal number of drinks to make you look more attractive. Not to make others look more attractive. So research indicates that you appear most attractive to others after you've had how many drinks?
I think it's one drink.
It is one drink.
Wow.
It is thought to be because after consuming one drink, the students in the study had a slightly rosier complexion, which can be a sign of good physical health.
Nice.
There's some other theories too, which you can read about on curiosity.com.
I will.
This one you should know because you're a nerd, just like me. The first printed instance of the word nerd occurs in a book published in 1950. The passage lists a nerd as a fantastical animal. Who wrote the book? And for a bonus point, what was the title of the book?
Oh, no. Was it like C.S. Lewis or someone?
Wow, you don't know this?
No, I don't.
Wow, you were stumped. The author was Dr. Seuss.
Dr. Seuss.
And the book was If I Ran the Zoo. The text reads, "And then just to show them, I'll sail to Katru and bring back an Itkutch, a Preep and a Prue, a Nurkle, a Nerd, and a Seersucker too." 1 year later, Newsweek magazine included the word in an article with its now familiar definition, someone who's kind of a drip or a square, which I think it's changed quite a bit. And some believe that nerd's popular usage evolved from the 1940s slang term nert, which describes a stupid or crazy person.
I want to just use the word Nurkle. I want a shirt that says, "Talk Nurkle to me."
Dr. Seuss rules. This is actually my favorite question. Which of the following sports was not once part of the Olympics? Town planning, poetry, tug of war, or euchre?
Euchre.
It's euchre. You're too good
at this. Town planning is the weirdest one, right? Can you believe that?
Yeah, tug of war was an official event between 1900 and 1920. Town planning was an event in four Olympic Games from 28 to 48. And poetry was an official Olympic competition from 1912 to 1948. Town planning fell under the architectural design category.
What? Oh, that old category. Oh, those great athletes.
Yeah. So for anybody saying, oh, esports should never be in the Olympics, come on.
Right. Town planning, man.
We've done a lot worse. Well, you knew almost all of those. So
all right. Well,
I guess you win the curiosity challenge.
Now I feel like a jerk for saying that I wouldn't.
Well, I will include links to all of those random trivia questions I just asked about in the show notes, so you can find those on curiosity.com or whatever podcast player you're listening on. Just tap on the podcast and you should see all the links right there. And traditionally, the guest brings something that's totally unrelated to anything. So, Ashley, I'm just going to let you ask me some random trivia question.
Okay. What is the lowest pitched saxophone there is in the world?
It's a contrabass saxophone.
I actually just learned this from Wikipedia this moment, because that is the answer I would have had. There is apparently a sub-contrabass saxophone.
What?
That is a full octave lower than the bass and like a fifth lower than the contrabass.
Wow.
Yeah.
I played the bass sax in a couple pieces.
It makes your whole head vibrate.
Yeah. It was about proportional for me, but yeah, the bass saxophone is pretty huge. I'm 6'4", so I'm very tall. And I know the contrabass sax, you have to like climb a ladder to play. That looks stupid. It literally looks like a tuba.
It looks like a tuba. It looks like like someone made a tuba into a saxophone. But it's more convenient than climbing a ladder, right? Because it's just all squat and fat.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can just sit in a chair.
Wow.
Wow.
That's a great trivia question. You did a lot better than me on the curiosity questions. Why don't we move on to the other question that we ask every episode?
Let's do it. It's time for this week's extra credit question. This one is a fun trivia question for longtime listeners. How many total weekly feature-length Curiosity podcast episodes have we released since we first launched last June? This includes numbered episodes and special episodes and does not count our new daily episodes or the episode zero we released before we officially launched the show. The answer after this.
It's not a secret that Ashley and I have been working on a new daily podcast where you can learn something new in just a few minutes every day.
That's the whole idea behind Curiosity.com, right? On our website, Facebook page, Instagram, and Twitter accounts, basically that's our goal. Make it easy and fun to get smarter.
So that's what our new daily podcast is doing. And we've been doing this weekly podcast that you're hearing right now for about a year. And it has been so much fun. But the daily podcast is going to be our focus for a while now. We've decided that with Memorial Day weekend coming up, we're going to hit pause on our weekly podcasts, at least for the summer.
Don't worry. You can hear us literally every day now with a new Curiosity Daily. So it's not like you can't keep listening. We're just going to hold off on feature-length weekly episodes like this for a while. And of course, we'll be happy to hear from you about what you think of the new direction we're taking.
Yes, please email us at podcast@curiosity.com or find us on Twitter to let us know how you feel about the move. And we'll take another look at what we're doing when August rolls around. Until then, we would love to keep reaching you every day on the Curiosity Daily.
You'll automatically get new episodes of our daily show if you're already a Curiosity Podcast subscriber. And you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Pocket Casts, Player FM, and everywhere podcasts are found.
You can also find links to listen to our daily shows in our email newsletter. If you're not already signed up for the email newsletter, then go to curiosity.com/email to sign up. We promise our emails are awesome. And of course, you can opt out anytime.
Our daily podcast is also part of the Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing skill. If you have an Amazon Echo, just tell your device, play my Flash Briefing. And if you've got Curiosity on your list of Flash Briefing sources, then you'll hear our new episodes that way.
There are seriously just so many ways to listen. We'll include links to all of this and so much more in today's show notes. So please check them out and follow us wherever it's the most convenient for you.
So to recap, subscribe on any podcast app, sign up for our email newsletter at curiosity.com/email, or add us to your Amazon Flash Briefing skill. It's so easy.
And now I think Ashley has an extra credit answer for you.
I sure do. How many total full-length episodes of the Curiosity Podcast have we released since we launched last June? The answer? 40. We have 37 numbered episodes, plus 3 special episodes. The first special episode featured Michelle Nichols from the Adler Planetarium, and she talked about the super awesome 2017 solar eclipse, which Joni and I covered live from Carbondale in August. Then we released a special episode similar to this one in December, where we played some of our favorite clips that we had to leave on the cutting room floor, as they used to call it. And of course, today's special episode season finale brings us to episode 40. Who was your favorite guest? Email us to let us know at podcast@curiosity.com, and we'll be sure to let him or her know. I'm sure they'd really appreciate it.
Well, this is really weird, but that's kind of it for this week / season on the Curiosity Podcast, at least the long ones we've been doing for the last year. I invite you to join Ashley and me on the Curiosity Daily, which we'll be back tomorrow, so it's not like we're going anywhere, to get smarter in just a few minutes every day, and we will have a lot of fun in the process.
I, for one, have been really enjoying hearing my own voice every single day.
Why do you think I do this for a living?
For the Curiosity Podcast, I'm Ashley Hamer.
And I'm Cody Goff. Thank you so much for your support over the last year. And one more time,
stay curious.
Yeah, it sounds cheesy.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.